You can want a little coffee, I think, to make sure you don't miss this show, too. It's worth staying up for. Maria Coffey, the author of Explorers of the Infinite, and an infinite number of other books, too. But we won't talk about those, at least probably not much tonight, because I want an update on Explorers of the Infinite. It's a book in which she discussed the extreme experiences of extreme adventurers and what happens to their bodies, their souls, when these mountaineers, these snowboarders, kayakers, base jumpers, and other people pushing their bodies beyond the everyday reveal their spiritual transformations and their experiences, which could only be described as paranormal. Maybe it's not. Maybe that's totally normal once you're in that zone. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why so many of these athletes, these adventurers, keep going back to that zone. They're addicted to that experience, and we'll tell you more about what she has learned since the book came out a year ago. We'll get an update coming up tonight on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Ponet. So Maria Coffey and I were chatting via email the other day, and it's nice to have you on so fast on Coast to Coast. Didn't know we'd be able to turn it around this quickly.
Oh, it's lovely to be back.
And lovely to hear your voice. But you'd been on the bean anyway lately, because I love when a book comes out that breaks ground, like Explorers of the Infinite does, in a place where, as you had said before, a lot of athletes, a lot of these adventurers had been unwilling to discuss these stories before they told them to you because they feared a lack of credibility, ramifications, that sort of thing. And so when you put that book out, it was really the first time that a lot of these stories had ever appeared on the record, correct?
Absolutely. I've been quite amazed by the reaction to it, too.
Yeah, so that's what I got to thinking about. I always love, like, given time and exposure, and you've had some great exposure for Explorers of the Infinite, that you'd be hearing from other people who would say, well, if you think that's weird, here's what happened to me.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it seems to be wherever I go now, I'm bumping into people, and a lot of different sort of adventurers, you know, will just say, oh, you know, I wish you'd interviewed me for the book, because I've got this story I could have told you.
Well, and that's what I want to get to tonight. So we'll share some of those. Will there be a sequel to Explorers of the Infinite?
I don't know. I'm really not sure. I mean, I'm very satisfied. I feel what I've done is kind of broken a taboo, and maybe other people will be more willing to tell their stories in other books.
Right.
And really, that's what I wanted to do. It's as if people now have got permission to talk about these things. I mean, I was really amazed. I was at the Banff Mountain Film and Book Festival, which is where a lot of the top mountaineers go to. That was last November. And Explorers of the Infinite was the best-selling book there, and I was absolutely amazed.
Well, that's surprising, though. I mean, you capture so many interesting ideas in here, the paranormal, the spiritual. And the way you describe it, these are things which explorers and extreme athletes of this type have been sort of addicted to. They knew about this long before they were telling you.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, I mean, you know, when I set out on the journey of writing this book, I wanted to try and prove that the lure of extreme adventure isn't just about adrenaline hits and endorphin hits. I always had this hunch that there was a spiritual lure, and that these adventures reached a transcendent state to which, in a sense, I don't like the word addicted too much, but something that they long for. They want to return to that spiritual state.
Or maybe it is an addiction, and not in the sense that it's a cheap addiction,
but good addiction, maybe.
Yeah, maybe like, you know, chocolate. So talk about this then. For somebody had asked me earlier this evening, like the stories that define Explorers of the Infinite. Before we get into updates, before we get to things that people have told you since, what do you think now, as you've had the book out for a while and you've told these stories a few times, what do you think are the ones that help explain it most for people who are trying to get their head around what this sort of zone brings out in human beings?
Well, I think one of the most, let's start with the more extreme stories. And do you want me to tell the story?
Yeah, by all means.
The story of Lou and Ingrid Whittaker. Lou Whittaker is one of America's top mountaineers. And back, about 25 years ago, he was on an expedition, an American expedition to Kanchenjunga. And he was at base camp, and they were basically each day going higher and higher on the mountain and returning to base camp, setting up fixed camps. And while he was doing that, his wife, Ingrid, was on her way up to the mountain leading a trekking group. Now, while Lou was on his own, he was on his own for 2 months on the mountain before she arrived, and every night in his tent, he had the sense of an elderly Tibetan woman in the tent with him, just a very comforting presence. And he was going, he probably would have told his wife about this when she arrived, but when she arrived, she immediately got a very severe bout of altitude sickness and spent the next 3 days in his tent extremely ill. And he was out on the mountain during the day, and when he came back at night, she was too ill to talk to him. But during the day, when she was on her own, every day she had the sense that there was this elderly Tibetan woman dressed in traditional clothes there with her, comforting her, helping her to turn over, sometimes even stroking her forehead. Now, she didn't tell Lou about this. After 3 days, the symptoms were so severe, she had to go down to a lower altitude. She went back to North America. A month later, he returned. And shortly after he returned, one day she very tentatively started telling him about this ghost that was with her in the tent. He said, well, that's really bizarre because I had exactly the same experience at night. And until they told me this story, they told very few of their friends because they said, oh, you know, everybody would have thought we were crazy. And I asked him, what do you think that was all about? And he said, well, Kanchenjunga has such an ancient history, I think maybe some of its spirits sometimes break through to our reality. Excuse me. So, I mean, I think, you know, that's one of the more extreme stories.
Right. Mm-hmm. Oh, I love that. And what's neat about that is obviously the simultaneous sort of exclusive experience that they were having, mm-hmm. which helps back up the other one. Do you have a little bit of a dry throat tonight?
I do. I'm just going to have a cough.
Okay, that's just fine. Have at it.
I'll be fine now.
Yeah. But this is where, this was actually the example that I gave to somebody in a sort of a thumbnail version of that story earlier. Because mm-hmm. I think, too, that's a really good example of that. But now the response was, well, that's just people who are deprived of oxygen.
Okay, so then here's another story from the Canadian Rockies. Which I think I might have shared with you before, and so not high altitude at all. Two young men were climbing, ice climbing, and the waterfall they were climbing up collapsed and buried one of them under a huge pile of ice. And he was the other one, the second guy climbed down to him and found his friend in an absolutely terrible state. Dreadfully injured. One eyeball had popped out, his ribs had collapsed, his face was smashed up. He was just in a really, really bad state. So his friend, Clay Hunting, this was before the days of cell phones, had to hike out through the whole night to get somewhere where he could call for help. And his headlight was fading, and he was, you know, really worried about getting lost. He was hiking out through all these canyons. He was terrified about his friend not getting there in time to save his friend. And he realized that there was a blue light that was guiding him. And he said he's convinced that it wasn't his headlamp because sometimes he'd actually turn off his headlamp and look for the blue light. And sometimes it would be to the right, sometimes to the left. And wherever it was, he'd followed it. And eventually he got out to a place where, just in time, he called for a helicopter, and they came and picked up his friend, and they got into hospital literally just in time to save his life. Mm.
And then the origin of the blue light?
Who knows?
Never.
I mean, there's no explanation for that.
Had he offered that he had seen a blue light and was following a blue light, and had anybody responded to him and said, oh, well, that's the such and such a light, that's a local legend or anything like that?
Nobody has come up with an explanation. He doesn't have an explanation. He said, you know, he wasn't somebody who believed in the paranormal at this point, but he absolutely believes that that saved him. Do you have time for one more?
I hope so. I think we have 3 hours.
Okay.
We have lots of time. And these are the types of experiences. It's the consistency of the experience that makes the case. So even though these are anecdotal, I think when the, when seen together in the mosaic, they really do, they point everybody, I think, in the same direction, which is, you know, why we're talking about the book Explorers of the Infinite. This is Maria Coffey, if you just tuned in. So what else then? What else would, where that would defy the stereotype that some people might use to dismiss a story like this and just say, well, it's just, it's people who are, you know, they're like, they have low blood sugar and no oxygen.
Okay, so one that isn't a climber.
Well, yeah, I mean, it doesn't have to be, but it just, I want to make that case that this isn't just a bunch of people who are, you know, whose bodies have not adapted to the environment, but these are something that's happening with their bodies or with their souls, with the spirit that they have, that is, it puts them in a different place, that they see things and feel things even differently.
There's one story in the book about a pair of climbers known as the Burgess twins, Alan and Aid Burgess, who were climbing in the Dolomites. Again, not at all high altitude. Very experienced climbers. And they climbed together as a team since they were very young. And one of them, Adrian, was higher up, leading his brother. And his rope dislodged a piece of rock, which hit a ledge and shattered. And he saw these big lumps of rock, I mean, really large lumps of rock, heading down towards his brother. And one was just headed straight at his brother's neck and shoulders and would have probably killed him. And he yelled down to his brother, but it all happened in a split second. At the same time, his brother looked up, saw the rock coming, pressed himself against the wall, expecting to be knocked off. And suddenly he turned, and the rock, which had been heading directly towards him, was sitting next to him on top of his day pack, this very large rock.
Mm.
And his brother said what he saw was this rock heading down towards his twin and then suddenly seeming to float off to one side quite gently and land on his brother's day pack. Now, the brother who was higher up has always been very skeptical. The brother that was lower down, who was in danger of being hit by the rock, is somebody who is very spiritual, has been studying yoga for many years, mm-hmm. spent a lot of time meditating in the Himalaya, really believes in the power of chi. And what he believes, the brother who survived the fall, was that something happened. Something happened in that split second. It could have been, he said it might have been a guardian angel, if you want to believe that. It might have been his power of chi suddenly protecting him and deflecting the rock. But they both believe that something very bizarre happened to change the trajectory of that falling rock. I mean, basically, the impossible happened, and that rock just floated to one side. And even his skeptical brother, who actually was the first to tell me this story, he said to me, "Have you asked my twin about the floating rock?" And then he told me the story himself. And I was amazed because this was Mr. Skeptical telling me the story.
Yeah, really. The floating rock. Mm-hmm. I really love that. And so, again, these are typical experiences that you collected. So as you put these together, and there are lots of different things that you do on a regular basis. You travel the world. You're heading off to the Galapagos again in a couple of weeks?
In May?
Mm-hmm,
to lead a trip there. Get two trips there.
Right. And then when's your next trip to Vietnam or down around Antarctica?
Well, after the Galapagos, we go to Croatia to lead a kayaking trip, and then it'll be Vietnam in October, Thailand to study elephants, and then I'll be going to the Antarctic next March.
Yeah, I've heard a little bit about the elephant adventure. Tell us real quickly about that.
Oh, my husband is a veterinarian by training, and we've been studying elephants for the last couple of years in India and also now in Southeast Asia and Thailand. We're looking at the issues around the habitat of wild elephants and the welfare of captive elephants, and we're actually setting up a not-for-profit organization called Elephant Earth Initiative to help fund local organizations that work on these issues. And we'll be running some elephant trips there next year in Thailand.
So will the trips help to fund the elephant care?
Yes, it'll help to fund, the improvement of captive elephant welfare. So, you know, the conditions of elephants that are used, for example, in tourism or in logging. And also it'll help towards organizations that are working to protect the habitat of wild elephants, because that's a really big issue wherever elephants are. Elephants are extremely intuitive creatures.
You know,
they're amazing.
Well, tell me about that. I love every chance I get to get near elephants. I love zoos, but, you know, in the good kind of zoo sense, where you really get a feel that the elephant, while in captivity, is not in a kind of hell. But I think I always get a sense of peace from elephants, and maybe it's just me getting it from them. Maybe they really aren't in such peace, but that's what I always feel from when I'm around them.
I think you're absolutely right. They seem to have a real kind of wisdom and knowingness about them that's quite uncanny. And, you know, I feel, you know, when I'm in their presence. Yeah, I think that's really true. I mean, calming on the one hand. The other hand, you have to know that they're, you know, obviously that they can be very dangerous. But there is something so, I mean, I think they have a very powerful consciousness. There's no doubt about that.
I was looking at a survey that came out today about the smartest dogs, right? And they said that border collies are the smartest dogs. Year after year, they end up rating the highest. Would you put elephants at the top of the scale for smartest animals, or are we just projecting onto them some?
No, I don't think we're projecting at all. I think that, I think, you know, my husband really believes that they have that elephants and whales have a lot of commonality.
What makes them different? Why would an elephant be, say, any smarter than a tiger or, you know, a camel?
Well, you know, the way they form social groups, the way they, for example, when a female elephant is giving birth, other elephants will always stay with her, other female elephants. They will always, you know, you'll see the companion elephant draping a trunk over the elephant that's in labor. They grieve. They definitely grieve for their dead.
And don't they return and grieve for their dead?
Mm-hmm. Apparently, yes, they do.
Mm-hmm. Where they go back to the, almost like a human would, you know, to visit mom on Mother's Day or something. They make a trek to go back to the elephant graveyard, as it were?
No, I don't know. You know, this is something you should interview my husband about sometime, because he's the elephant man.
I've heard that from, like, people that are, I mean, that this has been verified, that elephants will go back to visit bones, that they know where the body went down, and they remember that.
I have heard that, too. I haven't witnessed it, but I have heard that.
Well, maybe you'll be able to witness that on one of these upcoming elephant adventure trips, if people are bold enough to sign up for it. Explorers of the Infinite was the book from a year ago. So we're just getting to a good place, I think, to take a break and come back and learn about some of the new things that people have been telling you. And then I want you, if you would, to do kind of a survey for us on as you had been tracking these stories, some of the conclusions you were able to draw, the similarities that you saw between these experiences, where you got to start to feel like this is how the pieces fit together. This is what we could all do. And maybe even a better idea, just how far would the average person listening to us right now, how far would they have to go? What would they have to do for them to be able to experience this one piece that only a few people get to lay a claim to? We'll come back to this coming up with Maria Coffey. And stand by. Find out how close you are to exploring the infinite. You can also link up to her and find out about all of her books. Just go through coasttocoastam.com. This is Ian Punnett. Mountaineers, snowboarders, kayakers, surfers, base jumpers, even people just like you who just get into a zone can find that there is some space out there that if it's addictive, maybe that's the best word for it, works for me, where you just want to keep getting back to it because it's where you find truth. It's where you might find either peace or a piece of yourself that you didn't know existed. That's what Explorers of the Infinite explores, and we will too. Coming up next with author Maria Coffey, we'll find new stories. The latest, people have been coming up to her and telling her, well, you know, I read your book and here's what happened to me. You'll hear about that coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Ponet. We're talking with Maria Coffey about Explorers of the Infinite. Just last half hour, she was talking about the Burgess brothers, right? The Burgess twins, the famous climbing twins. And Maria, I'm reminded that of the movie Vertical Limit. I can't even say it without laughing, but Vertical Limit, have you ever seen that movie?
You know, I haven't. I know people who, climbers who were involved in it, but I've never actually watched it.
Okay. It might be, I mean, it may be a really good movie for climbers, but I suspect it's probably not. It's probably, they probably do everything wrong the climbers are supposed to do, and that even the good climbers are doing everything wrong because for them to do it right would look bad on camera. So they have to do it the way that looks good on camera. Right. And so I don't know for a fact that it's totally bogus as far as climbing is concerned, but I know that there's these two characters are in the movie are based on the Burgess twins.
Oh, okay.
Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
I think they're called the Bench Brothers, and they are, they're from Australia or something like that. Uh-huh. But they're basically the Burgess twins.
Oh, okay.
And I remember that after the last time we spoke, somebody had emailed in and said, oh, if you've ever seen this movie.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, how interesting.
Yeah. So
I have to watch it now.
Yeah. You kind of have to just to see how they're portrayed by Hollywood,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
And how many things they can get wrong on climbing in one movie about climbing.
Yeah. Burgess twins got later in the program. They've got lots of amazing stories.
Really? Mm-hmm. I mean, so even the one that is skeptical about anything infinite.
Yes, I think so. I often wonder how skeptical he is. I mean, you know, they've told me stories of, for example, they've been in different parts of the world. They're very closely connected, obviously, anyway, as brothers, you know, because they've always climbed together. But they've told me stories that really sound as if they're in telepathic contact with each other, although they say they're not. There was one instance when they were in different parts of the world, and each of them had a skiing accident, and each of them injured his I think it was their knee. Both of them got a knee injury, one in his right leg and one in his left leg, and during the same week.
Hmm.
And, you know, I said to them, well, you know, I said to Adrian, the most skeptical one, well, what was all that about? And he said, oh, it just means that neither of us can ski very well. But, you know, I still think it's...
There's kind of a symbiosis between the two of them.
Yeah, and they've told me stories about being very high on a Himalayan mountain in a terrible storm without any kind of radio contact, you know, when they're in a complete blizzard, and that they basically, you know, move as one without having to yell and scream at each other to try and be heard, you know, that basically it seems as if there is some sort of, you know, communication between them. That goes beyond them just being a well-oiled team who've climbed together for many years.
Now, it's been a while since I've read Explorers of the Infinite, so pardon me on this. I'm pulling it up out of memory, but wasn't there a story, too, about other climbers that see things high up, too, when they're up there that they can't quite explain? And I'm trying to remember the blue light story is amazing, and I hope I'm not confusing that with this, but suddenly I had a sense memory of another climber that saw something that they were never able to explain. Does that sound right?
Well, there are many stories in the book of climbers having, seeing spirits on mountains or, you know, and some of those are explainable by the effects of lack of oxygen to the brain, I presume. But there are many, many stories of kind of inexplicable accounts of people being guided down the mountain.
Right, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah,
of.
Carlos Cosolia, who's a very famous Mexican mountaineer, has had many of those experiences that I recount in Explorers of the Infinite. For example, he was on K2 in a really, really terrible storm, complete whiteout, and he had to find his way back to his tent, which is his only means of surviving if he got back to his tent at a high camp. And he said there was one little snow bridge that he had to find to cross over a big crevasse, and he said it was like a needle in a haystack. And in this terrible storm, he was losing all sense of direction. And he believes that he was guided down the mountain by the spirits of the mountain and also by the spirit of a dead climber who died on that mountain.
Right. That's what I that was. Yeah, that was the part I was thinking of, because I didn't want to say that if that wasn't true, but that's what I remember, right.
And Carlos says that he has had many hallucinations that have been caused by lack of oxygen. And he says, I mean, he's climbed the world's highest 14 mountains without oxygen. He was the youngest person to do so. And he said he's had many, many oxygen-deprived hallucinations caused by hypoxia. And he said he absolutely knows the difference between those kind of hallucinations and what he calls his moments of extended reality.
Extended reality.
Yeah, and he said it's for those moments that he climbed so hard and pushed himself to the limit. He said he would, when he was very close to the edge of life and death, his actual words were, poof, then the channel would open, and he would go into that different reality. I mean, he also talked about having telepathic experiences. He was on, I'm just trying to think which mountain it was, on Nanga Parbat, climbing on one of the world's hardest mountain routes. And he was climbing with a Polish team. And when they were descending again in a terrible storm down a really dangerous route, they were in radio contact with each other. And at base camp, the people at base camp were picking up the conversation. Now, Carlos didn't speak any Polish. The Polish climbers didn't speak any Spanish. So they always used to converse in English. So they were coming down in this terrible storm, guiding each other down via walkie-talkie. When they got to the bottom, they listened to the tapes of these conversations. They'd taped them at base camp, and they were amazed to find out that Carlos had been speaking in Spanish, and the Poles had been speaking in Polish.
Oh,
I guess because the duress of the situation. And Carlos said they understood each other up there, and they guided each other down. They wouldn't have been able to get down without all of them helping each other, and they couldn't believe it. They listened to these tapes of their conversation, and they couldn't understand what each was saying. So he really believed, again, that they'd gone into these moments of extended reality where he thinks they were in some sort of telepathic connection.
Well, of course, that's the religious tradition of speaking in tongues.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I love that.
Yes.
K2 was the site of the movie Vertical Limit, by the way.
So, oh, okay.
To go back to that movie. So if you've been to K2, that might you might feel some you might see some things up there that are very familiar. Now, so again, we're talking with Maria Coffey, Explorers of the Infinite. Since the book came out, you've had a lot of exposure and done lots of TV and radio, and people have been logging on, reading your book. And I know lots of folks have also been getting in touch with you. You mentioned when you do appearances somewhere and signing books. So what have people been saying to you? Athletes, adventurers, how have they followed up with threads that you started in your book?
Well, many of them have come up and said, you know, I've had very similar experiences, and I wish it contacted me.
Right.
And they've been everybody from, you know, I mean, obviously I often, because of my climbing connections, I've been tending to meet a lot of mountaineers, but I've had several different sailors come up and talk to me about experiences they've had when they've been on solo sailing trips and have sensed the presence of another person on the boat. And a couple of them, actually two different people, have even said, you know, it was so intense, this sensation of another person, that they were even preparing food for them, or talking to them. I've also had people coming up. For example, a very famous mountaineer, Chris Bonington, famous British mountaineer. He's a very old friend of mine. And, you know, my original partner before my husband now died on one of his expeditions in 1982. Well, just recently I was talking to Chris. He'd just read my book. And he told me this story. And again, Chris is very skeptical. I thought he was very skeptical about anything to do with the paranormal. But he told me that in 1992, when he finally climbed Everest, which had always been his dream, he was on what's called the Hillary Step, near the summit of Everest. It's the last sort of big obstacle on the mountain, a very difficult technical climb. And he was struggling up it. He was halfway up, absolutely exhausted, thought he couldn't go on, when suddenly appearing right next to him was, all he can just say, it was like a living climber, somebody who was actually in Britain at the time, Doug Scott, another very famous climber, very old friend of Chris, who'd been on many expeditions with him in the past. Suddenly Doug appeared, floating at Chris's right-hand shoulder, talking to him and encouraging him all the way up the Hillary Step. And he said Doug was three-dimensional, completely real. He was just there but floating. And when he helped Chris all the way up the Hillary Step, not physically helping him, just giving him encouragement and advice, and when Chris got up to the top of the Hillary Step, Doug vanished. And, you know, I said to Chris, so what's the explanation, do you think? And he said, well, I was really at the... pushed to my limits. I think it was to do with that. He said, maybe it's the power of the subconscious. But then he paused and said, but isn't it amazing how much is tucked away in our subconscious?
Yeah. If that were just the subconscious.
Mm-hmm. If it were.
How one might be able to access that, like one might be able to access energy reserves, or or to burn off fat calories, or something that somehow the body is pre-designed to be able to do that, if only we knew how to do that. Going back to the sailor stories, and I think this is, you bring up something and it just kind of sticks with me a little bit, that because here you're talking about people who have sailed over a large area but entirely on their own. We're not talking about people going out for the afternoon and having a couple of drinks.
These are people who've been at sea for 21 days.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so what is there a consistency to the people who are making the appearances? Right. I mean, we talked about the guardian angels in the case of the Burgess twins, that there was seemed like there was just a almost like an invisible hand. So let's take that one off the table because they didn't actually see anything other than what seemed like the rock being halted.
Right.
But there you have your friend who's talking about climbing Everest, or the people who were in the tent and they had the appearance of the Himalayan woman. If it's something that's just locked in our subconscious, do we see a consistency to what gets locked in there? Or rather, when we need to activate some external image to motivate ourselves internally, is there a consistency to the type of image that we are projecting?
Well, most of the people that I talked to, it was, for example, the climbers, it would be other climbers that would appear with them on the mountain. And sometimes it would be climbers who died, for example, on Everest in the 1950s. You know, some of the old famous climbers, like one climber who got to the top of Everest by the Kanchung route alone, which is very difficult. Eric Shipton appeared next to him, who was an old explorer who climbed on Everest. Hadn't died there, but and I talked to one polar explorer, Peter Hillary, the son of the very famous climber Edmund Hillary. And he was on a 3-month trip in crossing the South Pole ice, the ice cap, and he started seeing, as he was trudging across the ice day after day, week after week, he started seeing the spirits of climbers who he'd been with on previous expeditions who died. And one after the other, they would appear to him and keep him company. He actually said that he began to look forward to these visitations. And then eventually his mother, who had died when he was a young man, she appeared on the ice as well, looking exactly the age that she was when she died. And she accompanied him day by day. Peter doesn't actually believe that these were ghosts. He believes that these were being summoned up somehow deep from his subconscious. He said it was almost like breaking through a membrane, some sort of strange process of osmosis where these people could break through into his day-to-day reality.
Right.
He said it was like his past being projected in front of him, but being projected in a very real way. But whatever it was, he found it immensely comforting and immensely helpful. And I think the one commonality of all these things is that often, all this phenomena is that often these spirits, whatever they may be, are often guides, are often comforting, often help people through a very stressful and very, very dangerous situation.
Sure. When his mother appeared to him, did she say go back or go forward?
No. From what he told me, and he's also written about this as well, there was no judgment. She was just there with him on the ice day after day, keeping him company.
Do you know of any stories of people who have encountered spirits that have told them, go back?
I'll have to think about that. I can't think of one right off the top of my head. No, it's normally people... The spirits are normally helpful. I can think of one example.
But maybe going back is what's helpful. Is my point is that maybe I'm just curious whether or not they have that experience, because if maybe going back is the right thing to do.
I've just thought of one. Sherry Bremer Kampf, who was when she was on Kanchenjunga, and her husband died on the mountain, and she lay down next to him. She was so devastated by the fact that he died of cerebral and pulmonary edema when they were very high in the mountain at 26,000 feet. And she lay down and was prepared just to die with him. And her two children appeared in front of her and actually asked her, you know, didn't actually, but, you know, their presence was basically saying to her, you know, we need you, please come back.
Absolutely fascinating.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And she says that is what stopped her. She felt herself actually going down the tunnel that she knew her husband had gone down, and she said that is what stopped her. She knew that she had to go back to life and get down to the mountain, down the mountain alive, which she did. She lost all her fingers, part of both of her feet on the way down, but she did get back to her children alive. And she said it was them appearing. They were just standing there in a kind of beseeching way, and that was what made her turn back from the tunnel.
Holy darn. And what that would have been like for her... To lose her husband right there on the mountain. Mm-hmm. I mean, even that in itself is an extraordinary experience. I mean, I can't imagine what that would be like to think. And then to know that very likely she would have to leave him up there?
She did, yeah. I mean, they woke up one morning. They were about to go for the summit. He started coughing up blood. His sight was going. He was a doctor. She was a nurse. They both knew this was extremely serious. He stood up and basically, you know, he basically just fell over and died. And they tried to move him a little way down the mountain, but, you know, they couldn't move him very far. And then eventually, you know, he just died. And she stayed with him throughout the night. And it was during that night that the children appeared to her. Then the next morning she had to make the decision to leave him.
And she made the decision for life.
Mm-hmm. For her children.
Is he still up there then?
Yes.
Oh, I can't imagine. Well, you can. You know that a little bit about that. We can get to that. To Maria Coffey, Explorers of the Infinite. We're talking about both stories that were in the book originally, but also then stories of people reaching out to her since the book has come out to say, there's something that I want you to know about, and she'll get into that a little bit more coming up next hour, too. And let's see if we can't put these pieces together a little bit and see a broader view of what that means about the infinite and us next on Coast to Coast AM.